It's Diane. On my mind, listening back to my conversations with Congressman John Lewis, the civil rights leader and U.S. representative from Georgia, died last July. A few months later, the state he'd represented would help tilt the presidency to Joe Biden and give the U.S. Senate its Democratic majority. Now, Georgia is back in the news with its restrictive voting rights law, the very thing Lewis spent his life fighting against. Before his death, Lewis published a trilogy of graphic novels titled March, about his work in the civil rights movement. I spoke with Congressman Lewis about the second and third books, and we bring you excerpts of those today. We'll start with March 2. This is Congressman Lewis and his co-author, Andrew Iden. I spoke with them on February 10th, 2015. Congressman Lewis, talk about how this project came about.
Well, I must tell you, Andrew Iden, my co-author, came to me at the end of my 08 campaign. He had been serving as my communication person, and there was a discussion going on. People were saying, what are you going to do? The campaign is all over. And some people were saying this and that. I'm going here, I'm going there. And Andrew's saying, I'm going to a comic book convention, a conference. And people started laughing, just laughing. And I said, you shouldn't laugh. I remember there was another comic book called Martin Luther King Jr. and the Montgomery Story. And that book inspired me to get involved in the civil rights movement. And so later, Andrew came to me and said, Congressman, you should write a comic book. You too should write a comic book. I said, oh, no. And then he kept coming back over and over again. And I said, yes, if you do it with me.
I have that first comic book right here in front of me. You know, it brings back such memories. It's got the price on it of 10 cents. Martin Luther King and the Montgomery Story, December 5th, 1955, Walk to Freedom, December 21st, 1956, Victory for Justice. Andrew, talk about your own thinking in these lines.
Well, the comic book Martin Luther King and the Montgomery Story served as a primer for so many individuals who were trying to understand how they could use nonviolence to affect social change. Later, I did my graduate research on this comic book and found out that Dr. Martin Luther King himself had edited the script, something I'd never imagined, you know, Dr. King poring over a comic book script at his desk in 1957. But it was used by Dr. King and Jim Lawson and A. Philip Randolph and others to help inspire some of the earliest acts of civil disobedience of the civil rights movement. And then it went on to be translated in other languages. It was used in South Africa. It was banned there for being incendiary by the South African government. And then it went on most recently to be used in Tahrir Square in 2011 to help educate the activists there how to properly use nonviolence.
A comic book.
Yes, ma'am.
Isn't that extraordinary? And then, Congressman Lewis, when March Book One came out, you must have been surprised by the reaction.
I couldn't believe the reaction that we received all over America. People started reading the book, making telephone calls, writing notes and letters. Students, we go and do a book signing here and there, and you see these young people getting the book, taking it to a desk and start reading. It's amazing the reaction of the book. As a matter of fact, it's been translated in French, and several other organizations and groups are considered translating the book.
It was a New York Times bestseller, received a 2014 American Library Association Award, Coretta Scott King Book Award, an ALA Notable Children's Book designation, which I find interesting, and was one of the Young Adult Library Services Association 2014 top 10 graphic novels for teens in 2014. I think that's extraordinary because what it says is young people really want to understand how all this happened, Andrew.
Absolutely. I think this generation is hungry to understand how they can deal with many of the frustrations they see in our society today. And I think they want to know how it was done by another generation. Part of what I think made book one and now book two so successful is the congressman's story is one of a young person growing up poor in rural Alabama with everything stacked against him. And through perseverance, hard work, and self-discipline, and a profound belief in the philosophy and discipline of nonviolence, being able to rise above that and challenge not just the status quo, but governors and presidents.
And book two, Congressman Lewis, focuses on the Freedom Rides. Remind us of that campaign.
Well, in 1961, when I was 21 years old, the same year that President Barack Obama was born, black people and white people couldn't board a Greyhound bus together, a Trailway bus together in Washington, D.C., and travel through Virginia, through North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi. We were on our way to New Orleans to test a decision of the United States Supreme Court. It was my first time coming to Washington. We spent 3 days going through an orientation. 7 African American and 6 white American. I remember so well, Diane, I remember so well, just like it was yesterday. The night of May 3rd, we went to a Chinese restaurant in downtown Washington, D.C. to have dinner. And someone said, you should eat well because this may be like the Last Supper. I never had Chinese food before. It was a wonderful meal. The next morning we got up, some boarded a Greyhound bus, some boarded a Trailway bus. And the first major incident occurred in a little town called Rock Hill, South Carolina, about 35 miles from Charlotte, North Carolina. My white seatmate, the two of us, tried to enter a so-called white waiting room. It was marked white waiting, and a group of Klans people attacked us and beat us and left us lying in a pool of blood. The local police officials came up and wanted to know whether we wanted to press charges. We said, no, we come with peace, with love, and nonviolence. Several years later, to be a factor, one of the guys that beat me and beat my seatmate came to my office in Washington in February 09 and said, Mr. Lewis, I'm one of the people that beat you. His son had been encouraging his father to seek out the people that he wronged. His son was in his 40s. He was in his 70s. He said, will you forgive me? I want to apologize. And I said, I forgive you. I accept your apology. His son started crying. He started crying. They hugged me. I hugged him back. And I started crying.
I want to go back to that orientation because I think that's extremely important here. And Andrew, maybe you want to chime in, but I'd like to understand exactly what that orientation involved, what you were told, what you could expect, and how you were instructed to react.
We were told what could happen, that we could be beaten, we could be arrested, we could be jailed. We could be seriously hurt, or we could die, we could be murdered. But we were taught to adhere to the philosophy and to the discipline of nonviolence. We were taught to look straight ahead. If we were sitting in at a counter or in a little restaurant or in the waiting room, be peaceful and orderly, and never, ever show any sign of fear or show any bitterness or any sign of hate. And become like one family, and that's what we did.
How difficult was it for you, Congressman Lewis, to maintain that aura of, I will not react?
Well, by the time of the Freedom Rides, I had accepted the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence as a way of life, as a way of living. I came to the conclusion that I had to respect the dignity and the worth of every human being. And not anything was going to make me dislike or hate someone because of what they might do to me. And that's the way I lived since my early involvement in the civil rights movement as a student in Nashville. So you get beaten, you get arrested, you left bloody, unconscious, but you never give up, you never give in, you keep the faith, and you keep your eyes on the prize.
Your relationship with your parents suffered during that period.
During that period, I felt like I had lost my mother, my father.
Why?
They didn't understand what I was all about. They thought I had lost my mind. They said, we sent you to school to get an education, and now you get involved in that mess. My mother would say, you're going to get hurt. You're going to get killed. We're going to lose the farm. We're going to lose the land.
Because they felt the power of outside forces coming against them because of your actions?
Oh, yes. My mother and father felt very strongly that something could happen, not just to me, but could happen to them and to my sisters and to my brothers.
So what happened during that period? You simply were out of contact with them?
Well, for a long time, we were sort of separated. As a student, I was in Nashville. They was many miles away in Alabama. And I would write letters, and they would write a letter my mother would urging me to stop, that something was going to happen to me. She really thought that I was going to lose my life.
And you spent your 21st birthday, February 21, 1961, in jail.
I was in jail. I was in jail in Nashville, Tennessee, when I became 21 years old. And the first time I got arrested, I tell you, I have not looked back since. Being arrested the first time, I felt free. I felt liberated. Because people had to use jail as a threat that you would stop. You would get out of this mess. You would get out of this movement. But it made me more determined.
How were you treated while you were in jail?
Well, from time to time, we were treated well. But when we went on the Freedom Ride and we were arrested in jail in Jackson, Mississippi, where we filled the city jail, filled the county jail, and later we were taken to the state penitentiary at Parchment. And there was hundreds of us, almost 400 young people and people not so young. There was ministers, lawyers, doctors, teachers, college professors, black, white, Asian American, Latinos, came from all over America and went to jail. And we'd be arrested together. We get there, they separate us on the basis of race. Put all of the white men, all of the black men in a particular bullpen. And they treated us like we was animals in a cage. You walk in, the guy said, sing your freedom songs now. We have ends here. They're going to eat you up. They're going to beat you up. Then you didn't have any clothing on there. We had to strip naked. And then they told us to take a shower. And while you were taking your shower, they had a rifle, a shotgun drawn on you. And if you had any facial hair, a mustache, a beard, you had to cut it off. And then in twos, you were asked to go into your cell after finishing the shower. And they gave us a pair of Mississippi State Penitentiary shorts and a shirt. And you can only take one shower a week. You can only attempt to write one letter a week. You couldn't have any books, only books. The only books you could have was the Bible. And a group came from the Salvation Army and brought us the New Testament and Psalms, the Book of Psalms.
And what about food?
The food was not the best. It was not the best. I tried to learn to drink coffee, but I couldn't take it. It was not the best. It was on a tin tray, and it would be syrup and biscuits, and the syrup was so bitter. I don't think we had grits. But somehow, in some way, we survived. I was there for 44 days.
44 days. And then somehow all of you were released simultaneously?
We all were released. We all tried to get out within 44 days in order to appeal our cases.
Because that was the limit when you
We had to pay $250 or serve 60 days, and we all got out within 40 days. 44 days.
And then you appealed your cases?
We did, and finally the state of Mississippi dropped all the charges against us. And the signs that said white waiting, colored waiting, white men, white women, colored women, came tumbling down on November 1st, 1961.
A quick break. When we come back, my conversation with Congressman John Lewis about the third book in the graphic novel trilogy, March. And we're back. In October 2016, right before Donald Trump won the presidency, I invited Congressman Lewis back on my show to discuss the third book in his series titled March. He came on with his co-author and policy advisor, Andrew Iden, and the graphic artist for the series, Nate Powell. Congressman Lewis, in 1963, the calls really, really began for one man, one vote. How did it begin?
Well, in 1963, when I was much younger, had all of my hair and a few pounds lighter, it was my responsibility to speak at the March on Washington. And I remember reading a copy of the New York Times and saw a group of black women in Southern Africa carrying signs saying, one man, one vote. So in my March on Washington speech, I said something like, one man, one vote is the African cry. It is ours too. It must be ours. So the young people in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee start using it as a slogan. We put it on cards and letterheads. One person, one vote, one man, one vote. And we went all across the South organizing and mobilizing. And we were determined to make it happen.
And where was President Lyndon Johnson in all this?
Well, in 1963, when we started speaking of this, he was vice president, and later, after President Kennedy was assassinated, he became the president. And he shepherded and got the Civil Rights Act of 1964 passed and signed into law, and said very little about voting rights. So we came back demanding that we get a Voting Rights Act through the Congress. And President Johnson said, you know, I just signed the Civil Rights Act. We don't have the votes in the Congress to get a Voting Rights Act passed. And he said, in effect, if you want it, make me do it. And we intensified our efforts. We went to places like Selma and other parts of the South. And on Bloody Sunday, March 7, 1965, a group of us, 600, made a decision to walk from Selma to Montgomery to dramatize to the nation and to the world that people of color wanted to register to vote. So we were beaten, we were trampled by horses, tear gas, left bloody, and some people died that came to volunteer to help. And President Johnson responded by speaking to a joint session of the Congress and made one of the most moving speeches any American president made in modern time on the question of voting rights, of civil rights.
And we have a clip of President Johnson speaking on March 17, 1965. Let's hear it.
There is no cause for self-satisfaction in the long denial of equal rights of millions of Americans. But there is cause for hope and for faith in our democracy and what is happening here tonight. For the cries of pain and the hymns and protests of oppressed people have summoned into convocation all the majesty of this great government, the government of the greatest nation on earth. Our mission is at once the oldest and the most basic of this country: to right wrong, to do justice, to serve man.
And gaining justice in that era still in today's world does not guarantee that that vote is there for every single person.
Well, I've said over and over on so many different occasions that the vote is precious. It's almost sacred. It is the most powerful nonviolent instrument or tool we have in a democratic society. And all of us must be able to use it. Use it for good. Use it to change things, to bring our people together, and help create what Dr. King called the beloved community.
I wonder how relevant you see this book, Andrew, in today's world, considering the kinds of incidents of police shootings, of shootings in absolute innocence that have happened recently.
I think when we started this, we felt we were telling history. But as we got to book three and through book two, it felt as if we were telling a story of America today. And March succeeds not just because of the story it tells, but because it's a graphic novel in particular. This generation, they're digital natives. They grew up on the internet. So they grew up reading in sequential storytelling form, right? Words and pictures. That's what a meme is. That's what, you know, most of our communication methods are, whether it's Facebook or Instagram or Twitter. These are words and pictures coming together to tell a story. And so if we want to reach this generation with this story so that they understand and feel connected to another period, to the 1960s, to this sense of revolution, then we have to do it in their language. And so by doing it in a graphic novel, we make it, as the Congressman says, we make it plain, we make it real. And that's, I believe, a big part of why you're seeing so many people reading March.
And Nate Powell, why you're seeing so many people connecting what's happening in March to what's happening today?
Well, I think that as a creative team, increasingly from March Book 2 to March Book 3, we found the contents not only echoing and paralleling a lot of what was happening in 2014, 2015, 2016, but the connections became so powerful in that third volume that we had to kind of regularly discuss the fact that a lot of these accounts of 1964 and 65 were, for us as a creative team, much more, in some ways, about 2016, about 2017, about 2019. And beyond that, we determined that we really didn't have to lay anything out extra. We let the story tell itself. We sort of trusted the contract with the reader or the viewer, and being able to be a part of that discussion publicly and privately with readers has been very meaningful in terms of illuminating and pushing that facet of the book.
All right. I want to take a caller. Colin in Silver Spring, Maryland. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I just wanted to mention, I'm a product of Montgomery County Schools. I went to BCC, which for a long time was a top 50 high school. And I can count on one hand the two times that we discussed either slavery or learned about the civil rights movement in public school. In high school, we never once discussed it. We were required to take two American history courses and an NSL, and we never did much history regarding the Black experience in America or the civil rights movement. And there was such a level of sterility when we did discuss the civil rights movement, as if it was like the climax where suddenly, okay, now everything's better. Mm. This is where it ends.
And what you're demonstrating with this particular book is how it came about, what you all went through, but the story continues clearly.
Well, I think that's part of where our decision came from to frame the story around the inauguration of President Barack Obama, Congressman Lewis speaking to the students that day. But, you know, March is changing this. We've already got school systems like New York City Public Schools, City of Atlanta Public Schools just announced last Friday. Schools all across the country are using March. And I think it's because so many teachers see that their students need to feel their own power. They need to understand what they're capable of. And it's hard not to feel as if there was a deliberate and systematic effort years ago to keep nonviolence out of schools because they were afraid of young people recognizing their power. But I've been on Capitol Hill for 10 years. I've worked for John Lewis. I've worked for other members of Congress. And I can tell you, most elected officials, they're more afraid of young people than young people are of them. And if we can show them their power and what they're capable of doing and how another generation did it, I don't think there is a limit to what they're capable of doing to move America forward.
Interesting, Congressman Lewis, that in this young man's classrooms here in Montgomery County, one of the wealthiest, most educated counties in the country, almost nothing taught.
Well, it is very sad that in this day and age, so many of our young people, whether they be African American, white, or Latino, Asian American, Native American, they're not receiving the education of learning what they should grow up learning and knowing something about. The Civil Rights Movement was about freeing and liberating us all, creating the sense that we're one people, that we're one family, that we all live in the same house, not just the American house, but the world house.
And those kinds of sentiments, Nate Powell, are difficult to convey on the page in drawings, but somehow you managed to do it. You were pulling, you said, from your own experience growing up in Mississippi. What was that like in your own day and age?
Well, the older I get, the more compressed that passage of time becomes between my parents' generation and my own. So growing up in elementary school in Montgomery, Alabama, my Mississippian baby boomer parents would give me a pretty basic working knowledge of the civil rights movement, just key moments, key figures. And as an aside, importantly, though, for this project, I kind of carried into adulthood that this is a default part of the American kid's experience is growing up with this kind of knowledge of the movement embedded, as slight as it was. A lot of their tales, however, would sort of be peppered with this exception at the end, that it was a different time. Uh-huh. And I've spent much of my work on March countering that with Congressman Lewis's mandate. You know, if you want to tell me that nothing has changed since then, come walk in my shoes and I will show you change. But at the same time, as a kid, you know, my parents were telling me stories of what was happening 15 years before the fact, 10 years before I was born. And that's nothing.
We have a tweet from Tenise, who said she was teaching March, the book, when Ferguson happened. Students were able to connect the visuals, the graphic novel, the news cycles, so it became so much more powerful.
Well, that is great to hear that these young people, with a wonderful teacher, had the courage and the know-how to say to her students through teaching, this is what happened in another time, in another period.
And another tweet, voter ID laws have roots in pre-Voting Rights Act suppression of the black vote. This is why the history of the 60s is so important today. Do you see efforts at work to suppress the black vote, or is this a legitimate concern about illegal voting, Congressman?
I truly believe there is a deliberate, systematic effort to suppress not only the black vote, but the vote of young people, senior citizens, and people that some people feel or believe that you're not going to be voting our way. It's taking place not just in the South, but all across America, and we have to stop it.
An email from Eddie. Talk about the Democrats who passed Jim Crow laws and the Democrats who filibustered civil rights legislation. Congressman Lewis?
Well, we had in the American South for many years politicians that supported segregation and racial discrimination. Schools, the laws, areas of public accommodation. But at the same time, we had Democrats outside of the South, in the Midwest, the Far West, the Northeast, who stood up, who spoke up and spoke out. And we created a climate, an environment that changed America forever. Democrats working with Republicans got the Civil Rights Act of 1957 passed, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 passed, and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And I say over and over again that when people say nothing has changed, the signs that I saw, they're gone. Growing up in rural Alabama, visiting Montgomery and Birmingham, little towns like Troy, going to school in Nashville, those signs are gone. They're not in Atlanta. They're not any place in the South. But we have problems, even today. But as a people, we will continue to make progress. We cannot go back. We're going forward.
Let's go to Chris in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, you're on the air.
The question I have is for Congressman Lewis. I was just wondering if, in light of what appears to be institutionalized racism, frankly, in a lot of police departments all over the United States, is it going to take another widespread, long-term, very concerted effort, again, like another civil rights movement, you know, now to root that out, to take care of that? Or do you think there is any way to remove that and really get it, you know, taken care of, and so that, you know, there is just no more of that institutionalized racism there?
I think it's important for all of us to be taught the ways of being a little more human. Individuals, not just young people, but all of us as citizens, police officers as well as the citizenry, should study the way of peace, the way of love, study the philosophy of nonviolence, and try to be kind to everyone, and just be human.
What about Black Lives Matter movement? To what extent, Andrew, I know as you were writing this book, you were thinking about what was going on today. How influential, how important can that be as we go forward?
We dedicated the entire series to the past and future children of the movement for that very reason. The Black Lives Matter movement is growing, it's developing, it's coming of age in some ways. I think what we hope to do is to show through these graphic novels how another youth-led movement was able to successfully pressure elected officials into changing the laws. I think we have a system that has neglected its most vulnerable citizens on several levels. Whether it is their treatment by some police officers, but also the mental health care system, housing, the financial system, education. There are so many issues where the most vulnerable citizens among us are being left out and left behind. And we have to have an activist generation to deal with it, because otherwise the country itself will be weaker.
I wonder, Nate Powell, whether you're already creating images in your head about Black Lives Matter. That movement has, I think, brought all these issues to the fore in ways that might have gone by as individual incidents, but Black Lives Matter has focused every one of us on what's happening around the country.
Certainly, that's been unavoidable, particularly when anticipating potential readership or audience of our story. And we've been fortunate enough to be involved with a lot of discussions on campuses and in certain communities that have resulted in a little more personal involvement with various local players within the modern day movement. It's also important that by the end of the March trilogy, there is no neat end to the story arc. Not only is it an account of true events, but we wanted to emphasize the fact that the struggle is ongoing. In Congressman Lewis's opinion, this was the end of the civil rights movement as he knew it with the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. But we also wanted to stress that the work and the struggle continued far after and continues to the present day.
Congressman Lewis, how important do you believe that the Black Lives Matter movement is to the growing understanding of what's happened to our country?
I truly believe that Black Lives Matter movement and effort, so important. You have this unbelievable growing group of young people, and it's not just Black people involved in it, Black young people, but it's white young people, Hispanic young people, Asian American young people, saying what affect one of us affect all of us. So it's the same way of the modern day civil rights movement. It was not a Black movement. It was all people working together for the common good.
And of course, what happened in Baltimore, do you believe that Black Lives Matter movement can truly have an impact on police forces across the country?
Well, I truly believe that this movement can have a major impact on police involvement and leadership, and as a group, make people a little more sensitive, a little more caring, and a little more careful.
Maybe what you've got to do, and it in addition to getting this book into elementary high schools and colleges, is to get it to police departments, Andrew.
I think that would be a great step. You know, Congressman has a saying when he talks about March. He says it's for young people and people not so young. And, you know, I listen to folks in Congress, folks on television, folks just in our community, and there just isn't an understanding of the nuance of the civil rights movement, of the tremendous commitment that had happened. You had a question earlier that talked about the role of Democrats during the movement. And yeah, Strom Thurmond was a Democrat when he outed Bayard Rustin on the floor of the United States Senate. But you also had a Republican, Everett Dirksen, who helped in the Senate to pass the civil rights and voting rights legislation, something you don't see today. Where are those people working across the aisle? And so when they look at it from a myopic vision, of course they don't understand it. And that's why it's so important that we teach every single person. We're not just playing catch up in our schools. We're playing catch up in our society so that every person who's able to vote, who wants to participate in our democracy, understands how we got to where we are today.
And there are an awful lot of people, because of the nature of this particular election process, who don't want to vote at all, Congressman. What do you say to them?
Everybody, each one of us must participate in the democratic process. We have to go out and vote like we never voted before. I follow every election since the election of President Kennedy in 1960. I've never seen anything like this. We have to get it right. If we fail to get it right, history would not be kind to us.
What do you think's gone wrong?
Something happened. I don't think it's in the water we're drinking. I don't think it's in the air we're breathing. But something happened, and I truly believe that we need to come together as a nation and as a people. And maybe I was thinking just earlier this morning and late last night, what created this? What created this climate, this environment? We want to live in a better place, in a better country. And we want to serve as an example for the rest of the world.
But how did you answer your own question? What did create this environment?
You know, I don't know exactly how to answer my own question. Sometimes I want to say, you know, that some force over there, group of people came together and made a decision. There's been so much meanness, so much hate.
That must really be frustrating for you on the Hill, where virtually nothing has gotten done.
Well, when I first came to Congress, we worked together. We pulled together for the common good, and something happened in the process.
Let's go now to Jim in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. It's a pleasure to listen to you folks discuss this. I'm a civics teacher in Charlotte, North Carolina, and when I heard the previous caller from Maryland call in and say that he hadn't been exposed to the civil rights movement, I was appalled, because I'm a public school teacher, and I teach that religiously in my class. That's something that should never be forgotten, because it affects all Americans, and for us to stow that away in the footlocker of history is an embarrassment. There's always something to be learned from this, and I expose my kids to the videos. Eyes on the Prize is a great video, and they're exposed to the violence. And they're exposed to the notion that people, Americans, your fellow Americans, have their rights suppressed and were denied their constitutional rights and their most basic human rights. And this is something that must be taught in every school.
And Jim, the question is, have you used March in your classrooms?
I have not. And listening to this just made me realize that's another fantastic tool that I need to get my hands on.
You bet. Thanks for calling and congratulations for your work as a teacher, which I have always considered one of the most important jobs in our country. So, what's next for all of you? Are you talking about this ongoing around the country? What are you doing, Andrew?
Well, we are going to go to the National Book Award ceremony the week after the election. I'm going to try and talk my mom into coming. And then I think the congressman's actually going to Nashville to accept a very prestigious literary award there as well. And then Nate and I will be going to the National Council of Teachers for English. And then we'll also be going to the Miami Book Fair. And that's all in 1 week, but that's the week after the election. So if we can survive, if we can get out there, and I think all of us are going to try and get out into the field and do everything we can to, in some way, stave off the apocalypse.
And how about you, Nate?
Andrew is very correct. I think that all the work that went into making the March trilogy revealed itself to only be half of the process. So now that the trilogy is complete and ready to get into people's hands, it's almost like the real work begins of relentlessly discussing its application, pushing it as far as we can go. I think when the first book dropped, we had no idea what the potential scope or scale was. And since then, we've been running to meet those challenges in real time.
Really an extraordinary outpouring of support.
Well, thank you.
And I wonder, Congressman Lewis, where you are going to be. I'm sure you will be at the National Book Awards, but you're also traveling the country in behalf of Hillary Clinton.
Well, I've been traveling, and I'm going to continue to travel all across America. It is so important that we elect her as the next president of the United States of America.
Congressman John Lewis of Georgia's 5th District, he and Andrew Iden and Nate Powell have produced March Book 3 and, of course, have produced the entire trilogy. Books, I assure you, worth reading and enjoying. You've been listening to Conversations I Had with former Congressman John Lewis about his graphic novel trilogy, March. John Lewis died last July. I'm pleased to tell you Congressman Lewis will posthumously release another graphic novel this summer. It's called Run, Book One, and it's about the period following the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.